Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we are live for an hour each weekday afternoon taking your calls. If you have questions about the Bible or about the Christian faith, be glad to talk to you about those things. And we can maybe even answer your questions in some cases. If we can't answer them, we can at least get them on the table. Maybe somebody else can answer them. Somebody can call in. And if you've listen to the program before, or in the course of listening to the program today, if you hear something you don't agree with coming from this host, you may feel free to call and to balance comment, because that's what we do here. We like to be open to what the Word of God says, and there's no assumptions here that the host knows it all. We do our best, but we are imperfect. And so if you see something more clearly than the host does, then feel free to give a call and we'll talk about it. You can balance comment or correction. The number to call, and by the way, all of our lines are open right now, so you can get right through. The number to call is 1-800-438-5090. 1-800-438-5090 is the number to call. And we have a question that was sent in by Brett, who asks, can you explain to me what Christ means when he is saying to deny yourself and to take up your cross daily in Luke 9:23 and 24? Is Christ also warning that this will affect our salvation? I certainly think it affects our salvation. Jesus is basically saying if you want to come after him, then you need to do so on certain terms and not on other terms, not terms of your own, but the terms that Christ himself lays out here. Now, if you don't come to Christ, I think that definitely affects your salvation. If you're going to come after Christ, you do it on his terms. If you don't come on his terms, then presumably Jesus is saying you don't come to him. And coming to Jesus is basically a condition for salvation. So I think it does. Now, what does it mean to deny yourself and take up your cross? Well, there's two things there. They're similar, but different. To deny yourself, I think, is not referring to certain individual cases of self-denial, like when you say, okay, I'm going to go without dessert today, or I'm going to quit smoking, or I'm going to sleep on a bed of nails or something. I deny myself certain comforts or certain things I desire, and that's going to be my self-denial. But that's not exactly what is in mind here, I don't think. It's not just talking about specific cases of denying yourself of certain things, but denying yourself wholesale, just completely denying yourself, that is the validity of you as somebody worthy of being in charge of your life. You see, what happens naturally when you're born is that you take charge of your life as soon as you can. And that means that the things you pursue and do are the things that you yourself want. And you set your goals for yourself. You have your own agendas. You have your vision you follow. You have your world to manipulate on your behalf. That's because you yourself are on the throne of your life. You're in charge. You have to deny that status to yourself to follow Jesus, because he has to become the one on the throne of your life. He has to be the one whose agenda, whose vision, whose pleasure you are seeking. That is, you're seeking to please God, to please Jesus. And that means though yourself likes to be in the position of authority, you have to say no. It's going to be Jesus, not me. That's what it means to deny yourself, I think. It doesn't just mean I deny myself, this eighth cup of coffee. It basically is I'm going to deny myself's claims upon myself, upon my life. And of course, that's legitimate, because why would you have any claim on yourself, on your life? You didn't bring yourself into the world. You don't own yourself. So why should you rule yourself? Why should you be allowed to do that? God owns you. God created you. And he should rule you. And that's what you come to when you deny yourself, deny the claims of self over self-rule of your life. But take up your cross has to do with taking on the uncomfortable and unpopular status of being a follower of Jesus. When you're carrying a cross, it's because you're a condemned criminal. you're rejected by society. You're going to be disliked. You're going to be ostracized. You're going to be persecuted in some cases. You take that up upon yourself willingly when you become a Christian. If you can't do that, you can't follow him, because frankly, that's what it's going to involve in some cases. Now, you and I, living here in the United States, don't experience very much of that, and it's very mild what we do receive. But certainly through much of history in most of the world, and no doubt here at some times, and maybe in the future, following Christ will involve outright persecution in a big way, possibly even martyrdom. Many Christians have suffered martyrdom in the past. You have to be ready for that. You have to be able to bear the cross of suffering and of persecution and so forth for Christ. So do you have to do that to be a Christian? Yeah, well, you don't have to suffer any particular amount. If no one persecutes you, that's not necessarily your fault if you're following Jesus. But you have to be prepared to follow Jesus no matter what it costs, no matter how much you suffer, even if you lose your life. That's the commitment that comes with being a Christian. Jesus said, if you want to come after me, you got to do that. You don't do that, you don't come after Jesus. Brett asked, does that affect your salvation? I think it does. I think if you don't come after Jesus, that very seriously affects your salvation. So that'd be my answer. Maybe someone else has a clearer or better answer than that, and they're welcome to call in and share it if they'd like to. And Brett, if you're listening, that's how I would answer that question. Let's talk to John from, we don't know where he's from today, but that doesn't matter. He can talk to us anyway. John, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hello, Steve. Actually, Monterey, California.
Monterey, great.
I've got a question. I've been somewhat dissatisfied. I've been a Christian for a while, and I read a lot of the older Christian books, like Spurgeon and Tozer, and I've been kind of dissatisfied with, like, church gatherings, church meetings, and I've visited a few, and I was going to one for quite a while, and I noticed that the emphasis wasn't there wasn't any fellowship. People didn't want to really get to know each other. It was more, I had all these ideas, and then I heard your series on Some Assembly Required, and I also read the book by Frank Viola, Pagan Christianity, and there was a lot of material in there that I was already thinking about, and I just wanted to see what your suggestions are to finding real fellowship. It's become kind of a problem, and it's hard to find.
I can tell you're kind of having a hard time putting it into a specific question, because it's sort of a systemic problem.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, you start out talking about some of the older guys like Spurgeon and A.W. Tozer, which tells me that you're looking for a deeper level of seeking God than you feel like you're finding in general in the Christians around you. And then you talk about the church is not satisfying you and so forth. And I understand that phenomenon very well. It's hard to know what to say. We're living in an age where a lot of people who will go to church probably don't have really a real relationship with Jesus at all. And if they do, a lot of them are fairly content to keep it peripheral or shallow or something like that.
Yeah.
And you're wanting to have fellowship with people who think like you do, which is that Jesus is everything. God is everything. Everything you do and choose is going to be referenced to God and his will and his kingdom. And it's really sad that you can go to church after church after church and feel like you're not finding any people like you in that respect, because frankly, every Christian is supposed to be like you in that respect. But you need to be careful not to think of yourself as superior. It may be true that you're living a life that is more desirable as a Christian and maybe even more true to biblical norms than lots of people you meet. But as soon as you begin to think that you're superior to them, you'll be inferior because you'll be proud, you know. So you have to be careful about that. You have to be careful not to be judgmental in an unfair way. Now, when I go to a church, many times, depending on what church I go to, I'll find, you know, there's certain things I don't agree with. It may be something in the message preached, or it might be something in the the way the worship is done or just the way the whole church is organized or something. I mean, there's lots of things you can find in certain churches that are not the way we feel they should be, not the way we think they used to be in the days of the apostles and such.
Yeah.
But we can't always change it. And so we've decided, what am I supposed to do? Am I supposed to boycott and not go to church? Or am I supposed to be there and do what I can to change it? I'll tell you, if you go and try to change it, there's two possibilities. One is that you can. One is that the people who make the decisions for the church and stuff will listen to what you have to say and say, well, that's, you know, I think you're right. That would make a better church if we did that. I think that's the way the Bible teaches. The other possibility is that the people who lead the church will resent the fact that you are trying to change the way things are done, in which case you won't be successful at all. Then you can decide whether you want to stay there and worship God in your heart and hope to find some other people who do so, or whether you need to move on and look for something else. I have to say that there were many years of my life, over a decade, where the Christians I fellowshipped with on a regular basis were in home fellowships only, because the churches I visited, for one reason or another, were simply not my idea of Christian fellowship. And so I was able to find some other people who met in homes who had similar yearnings to mine, and that was the fellowship I had for a long time. I'll tell you the truth, I attend a regular church now quite a bit. I've talked to the pastor and told him I don't believe in church membership, but neither does he, so I don't have to officially join. But I feel like God has really, in a sense, joined my wife and me to lots of the people in the church. It's a family. It's a very family-oriented group. But I've been looking for years. I'd have to say this church I'm attending right now, I like better than any church I'd attended in the previous 12 years. And during those 12 years, it was pretty lean years. I mean, lean in terms of, church fellowship. But I found Christians where I could. Now, I realize I've got an advantage. I have a radio show. And therefore, people who think like me sometimes get in touch with me, and I can fellowship with them. If you don't have a radio show, it's harder, a little harder to find people who are, you know, there might be, every church you go to, there might be some people who are like you, but you don't know they are, because like you, they're kind of keeping it to themselves, and they may be frustrated just like you are, but you don't know it because you don't know them. What I think is, if you find a church where there seems to be humble leadership, who honor the Word of God the best they know how, and where there's a fair number of believers who seem to be, not bored with following Jesus, if you stay there long enough, I think God will lead you to people, individuals who think like you do, enough that you'll find it refreshing. And you can always have, outside of the church meeting, you can always have fellowship with those people. And you just have to be gracious if you go to a church that you don't like the way they do worship or the way the preaching is or something, but they're good people, let's say, and they're sincere. You just need to be gracious. I mean, if you feel like you see things more clearly than they do, it's possible that this is so. But you can't get proud about it. And actually, the more you can endure and not compromise yourself, the more of a sign of strength that is and of maturity in your own part.
Yeah, I think, well, the reason I mentioned that I read those guys, some of the old Christian brothers have some really nice books out there, is because sometimes I feel inferior. I feel like maybe I'm just not seeing Christianity for what it really is. I mean, it seems like so many people attend service and they're happy.
Well, we need to remember... We need to remember that Christianity has been practiced in one form or another for the past 2,000 years. And in the process of practicing it, there have been many changes because, of course, it went from the apostolic type of Christianity into the Roman Catholic type for many years. And then there was the Reformed type, and then there's the Free Church type. Now there's all types. You know, you can go to any kind of church you want now. But the thing is, the kind of church that a person gets saved in or is raised in is likely to seem to them to be the right way. You know, there's different churches, different Christians worship differently, but what you're familiar with from your earliest Christian experience is what's going to seem normative. You're going to kind of assume that's the way the early church was. And so you're going to find people who are wrong about the way they do church, but they don't know it. I mean, that's the only way they know. They assume the early church did things their way. And you can't blame them for that. You know, you might be coming from another tradition where you see clearly that that's not the way they did it in the New Testament. But you can't assume these people are unspiritual or stupid or anything like that. It's just everybody's got some blind spots. So actually, if you remain among such people like that graciously and humbly, it may well be that God will use you to help them very gradually to see a better way. And in the meantime, hopefully you'd find some individuals who already see it your way, and you can get some satisfying fellowship outside of the church meetings.
All right. Well, I appreciate your comment. I hope so. I guess I just really yearn sometimes to have that kind of fellowship. And
yeah, I was there. I was there when I was young. I was reading Tozer. I was reading William Law and his Christian Perfection. I was reading Wesley. I was reading Finney. I was reading Spurgeon. I was reading those guys and feeling the same way as you. I was reading E.M. Bounds and lots of these old guys, the Puritans. And you start getting this idea that there were some people back in those days that had deeper walks than the people around you. And I was frustrated too because I didn't know where to go. But you know what I did? I found some home church, home Bible studies. These were not home churches. These are just like midweek home Bible studies that some churches held. Mm-hmm. I just started going to those. And you find that when you go to the midweek home Bible studies that churches hold, you'll find that they're smaller, of course, than the Sunday morning service. The reason is that a lot of people go to the Sunday morning service who aren't as serious. It's just a tradition to go on Sunday. But it's not really a tradition to go on Thursday or Wednesday or Tuesday or something like that. And therefore, the people who go to the midweek services often are the people in the bigger church that are more serious about wanting to study the Bible and things like that. And I found that by going to these home Bible studies, I ran into people who were much more eager to talk about deeper things of God in many cases. That's not always the case. Some home Bible studies are very, programmed, and they have a workbook they use or something like that, and no one studies very deeply. But there, I would think you'd find some. And I don't know what to recommend as far as which ones, but if you pray about it and start visiting some of these and give them a chance, you might find there's some, even if there's just two or three, or even just one person who sees it your way, it can be very refreshing.
Oh, yeah. I'll give that a shot. I'll keep trying. Because I long for my wife to have some older sisters to be discipled and to fellowship with.
I know you just have to wonder sometimes, since there are people like you and me and many others who are really looking for some real fellowship, why it is that there aren't more churches that are set up to provide that and that preach in such a way as to encourage that and so forth. I just don't understand. I can't understand why anyone would do church any other way than the way that the Bible would authorize. But they do it. You're going to have to live with what we got for the time being. And maybe God will change it. Maybe he'll even use you to help change it.
Okay. I won't take any more of your time, Steve. I appreciate your answers like always. And God bless you.
Okay, John. Thanks a lot.
Okay, thanks.
God bless you. Bye now. Okay, our next caller is Travis. I don't know where Travis is calling from either, but welcome, Travis.
Hi, Steve. Hey, I called you a couple weeks ago. I got a different topic. We kind of touched base on this a while ago, I think, and it was about the mark of the beast.
I'm sorry, the what?
The mark.
The mark of the beast, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, when we're talking about he forced everybody, small, free, poor, rich, to receive a mark on their right hand or forehead.
Uh-huh. Now, why is there so much noise in your environment there? There's some background noise that's almost as loud as you are. Where are you?
Is that better?
I think it is, yeah. Yeah, I'm not hearing that now.
I just turned the volume down. Basically, you came up with maybe it might have been possibly back in the Roman days that, the mark that was forced upon everybody, small, free, poor, rich. But that, as I was reading more, I realized that's not possible because it says those who receive the mark were eternally condemned. And that the bowls of wrath in the bowls were poured out on those who have received this mark and worshiped this image. So that's still future tense.
Well, it might be.
that initial conversation we had about it being in the past, it's impossible. Never happened.
Well, that would be true if the book of Revelation is about the future, and it sounds like that's the assumption you're making. The idea that Revelation is talking about future judgments is a very popular view in our time. It's a fairly modern view. Through most of church history, that's not the way Revelation was viewed. Most of church history, the book of Revelation was viewed as a panorama of the whole age of the church. This is called the historicist view of Revelation. It's not the view I hold, but it's a very different view than the view that you have heard and that I heard growing up. You and I probably have heard and gotten the impression as we read Revelation that it's about the end times, at the end of the world. That is called the futurist view, and that view is certainly not the only view that biblical scholars have ever taken. It's the most recent view to come up. The historicist view was much more common through more of church history. Another view is called the preterist view, which holds that the book of Revelation is talking about judgments that are now past. And I believe there's some validity in that view. Certain parts of Revelation I take that way. So you and I might have some different presuppositions about the book of Revelation that would affect the strength of the argument that you're making.
Uh-huh.
See, I'm not sure that those who take the mark of the beast and who receive the judgments are a future group.
Right. I think the thing about it is, on some of it, some people believe this and some people believe that, but a lot of the book of Revelation hasn't even happened yet.
Well, that's what's controversial, you see. A lot of people would disagree about how much of it has happened in the past.
Well, let's see. We're already in some of the trumpets and seals have already happened. A lot of Bible scholars say we're about at the fifth trumpet because first couple of trumpets were World War I, World War II, and we're right into the thick of the end times. Christ hasn't came and set up his kingdom on earth yet. There's just a lot of things about the third temple being built. That hasn't happened yet. So, I mean, it's a lot of sweeping under the rug and just kind of disregarding what the book of Revelation says.
Well, I certainly don't do that.
I don't know how people, huh?
Yeah, I want to tell you this. I certainly don't disregard what the book of Revelation says. I'm not sure if you're aware, I wrote a book called Revelation Four Views, a parallel commentary. It's 500 pages. I read 50 commentaries on Revelation. I accessed 50 commentaries in writing my book. That was 1997. I've taught through Revelation many times since. I'm not sweeping Revelation under the rug, but I'm aware of some things that I think you might not be aware of, because you're assuming that Revelation is about the end times. I'm saying to you that if you lived 200 years ago, you would not assume that. Because no Protestant Christian ever assumed that 200 years ago. So we're kind of the products of our own time in many ways, and it helps to consider other views and why other people hold them. To say that they're sweeping Revelation under the rug is simply to say you don't know why they're saying what they're saying. That's why the book I wrote, which I'm not trying to sell you a copy of my book, I'm just saying there are four views. I'm familiar with all four. I know the reasons for them. I know why you believe your view. And I know why people believe other views. Nobody is sweeping Revelation under the rug in these four views. It is that they are all making a very sincere attempt to read the book of Revelation in the light that the original readers would have read it, and not necessarily in the way that we've been taught to read it in the last few decades.
Well, you got the bulls of wrath, which hasn't happened yet. He hasn't poured out. He hasn't put his foot on the Mount of Olives. He hasn't set up his kingdom yet on earth. And ruling and reigning from Jerusalem. So you've got so many things economically that the Bible talks about in other books of the Old Testament of a one-world government. That's about ready to happen. I mean, we got so many things that you can tell by looking around the world. We were given warning signs about the end times. And plenty of warnings in the Gospels as well that all coincide and fit together in the book of Revelation.
Well, I'll tell you what, Travis. I mean, I'm certainly familiar with what you're saying. I don't mean to be condescending when I say I used to say that myself. I know that when a person says, I used to see it your way, it sounds very condescending, and I don't mean it that way. I just want you to know I'm familiar with your reasons for saying that, because I had those reasons too, and I said the same things. All I can say is there's more to the study of Book of Revelation than you've done. And that's really all I want to say. I'm not saying you're necessarily wrong. I'm just saying you could benefit by becoming aware of why there are other views of Revelation than yours. And you might even find that the reasons that people have for other views could be superior to the reasons you have for your view. By the way, of the things you mentioned, I just want to just comment just for the sake of accuracy. A number of those things are not mentioned in Revelation. Jesus putting his foot on the Mount of Olives, explains who is not in the book of Revelation. You're referring to Zechariah chapter 14. The third temple being built is not mentioned in the book of Revelation or anywhere else in Scripture. Certainly not in the New Testament and not in Revelation. There's no mention of a third temple being built. The idea of a one world government, you could read that into some passages, but it's not clearly taught in the New Testament, although there are passages in Revelation that could be seen that way, and I wouldn't say there can't be a one-world government. I think there could be. But the passages you're thinking of, I know which ones they are. They're in chapter 13. They can be interpreted differently than you think. You'd be surprised to know that many people believe that the bowls of wrath do speak of events that have happened in the past. And some of them have what look like pretty good reasons for thinking so. So I guess I'd just say the main thing about talking about Revelation is to not be overly sure of oneself. If you're too sure of yourself, it's probable that you have not taken into consideration what some people who've been studying it longer than you have taken into consideration. That's just my warning about that. The Book of Revelation is a book that's very controversial, and there is certainly more than one way to understand it.
Yeah, I think with me is I look at the other view that you're talking about, but to me, when you look around the world and you see what's happening economically around the world, it's all, you hear economists talking about a one world order, that they have nothing to do with the Bible, they could care less about the Bible.
Right.
But they're confirming what the Bible has been talking about in the Old Testament prophets.
I don't think the Old Testament prophets talked about that.
Huh?
I don't think the Old Testament prophets talked about that. Can you tell me which one did?
Probably Isaiah, Ezekiel, some Jeremiah. There's a little bit of everything in there.
Okay, those are some names of Old Testament prophets. Do you know of any passage where they spoke of a one-world government?
10 nations, one-world order.
Okay, those three books don't mention that.
Well, the book of Revelation does. It talks about Russia. It talks about Magog and Gog.
No,
Russia and Iran uniting in the last days.
Okay, I'll tell you what. I'll tell you what, Travis. You've listened to a lot of Bible prophecy teachers. Now, let me encourage you to read the Bible itself and see if you can find those things mentioned there.
About the nations?
Well, yes.
It's got the ten-headed beast.
I know about the seven-headed beast with the ten horns.
Right.
Yeah, I know all those passages. What I'm saying is, what you're saying they are about, you cannot find the Bible affirming that that's what it's about. That's what Bible prophecy teachers have told you, and not all Bible prophecy teachers are equally careful in their exegesis. I'm just warning you about that. Not everybody knows what they're talking about. Anyway, I appreciate your call.
Okay, Steve.
God bless you.
All right, bye.
We can talk again sometime. Bye now. Okay, our next caller is Mary from Las Vegas, Nevada. Mary, welcome.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a shout-out. A shout-out to Evangelist Ray Cordova. He was on the radio asking for money, and all he did was rip off older ladies, and He was using the money to take care of himself, and I want him to stop doing that.
Well, you might want to call him, because I don't think he listens to my show. I don't know him.
I think he does.
Oh, does he? Okay.
Yeah,
he does, on
KKVV.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, you know what? I'm on KKVV, too, but I don't live in Las Vegas, so I can't listen to the station. Does he live in Las Vegas?
I think he lives in Colorado and Las Vegas.
Okay, well, if he's in Colorado, he's not listening to KKVV, probably, and therefore, he probably doesn't listen to my program. But I would agree with you in objecting to that. If there's a minister who is asking people to send him money, And then he's using the money for himself.
KBV.
What's that?
On KKBV, he was asking for money all the time.
Well, okay, but I don't listen to him. I don't know him, and I don't think he listens to me.
I'm just giving him a shout-out, because I know he does listen. He does listen to the radio. Anyway, thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Mary. Good to hear from you. All right, let's talk to Jane from California next. And we've got a line open for you if you'd like to call, 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. Jane, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. A few questions, actually. Why is the Bible so difficult sometimes to understand? It's, you try to read it, and you were talking about Revelation with the prior gentleman, and Revelation is very difficult. Ezekiel is very difficult. There are certain books and passages of the Bible that are so difficult to comprehend.
That's a fact. Yeah.
And I wonder, why is it that God created the Bible that way? If it's supposed to be something that we can lean on and learn from, I mean, there's so many things that we struggle with.
Yeah. Well, let me put it to you in an analogy. Would you say that physics is hard to understand?
Yes.
Well, some parts of it are not, right? I mean, you understand the laws of motion, that when you're coming to a stop sign at a certain speed, you need to start slowing your car down because you're not going to be able to stop on a dime. The laws of physics tell you have to gradually slow down. So you know enough about that. You know enough about gravity that you don't jump off a bridge onto concrete, because you know the laws of physics say you're going to be squashed and die. We know some things about physics, even intuitive, even a child knows some things about physics, in many cases enough to stay alive even. But there are laws and theorems of physics that are so heady and so deep that neither you or I know about them or understand them, and it takes an expert, a scholar, to know them. And some of them are still being discovered, perhaps, you know, at least some of them still were in the last few centuries. So in other words, physics is a category which is the study of the physical world and physical laws and things like that. Now, some of those physical laws we use every day, and we either know them intuitively or we've learned them, and they're pretty simple. We can teach them to our children. You don't stick your, you know, a knife in the electrical socket. You don't jump in the deep end of the pool if you don't know how to swim. I mean, you can teach the simple things to the children, but the people who really want to get deep into it and understand the way the world works more, they go to school usually, or they study it out, and they learn the deep things that the average person doesn't have to know. I don't know that much about the laws of motion. I don't even know that much about gravity. I know one thing about it, and it tends to pull things down toward the earth, and so I adjust my life according to that. But you see, physics is the study of the physical world. Theology is the study of God and the spiritual realm of God. Now, that spiritual world is just as complex as the physical world, maybe much more so. But you don't have to know everything about it in order to function. A child can know God, but a child isn't going to know everything about theology. It's like the realm of the physical world and the realm of the spiritual world have something for everybody. People who want to wade around in the shallows can pretty much get by knowing a few basic important things. People who really want to go in deep, it seems like it's fathomless. It seems like you can go in deeper and deeper and deeper. Now, the Bible is the book that God has given us to reveal these spiritual truths. Some of the truths lay right on the surface. And frankly, a child reading them can pick it up and say, oh, I see, I'm supposed to obey my parents. I see, I'm supposed to love people. I see, I'm not supposed to lie. You know, there are things that a person can see and no one could miss if they read it. These are the basics. But there's also deep things, things that even the smartest theologians don't have sorted out completely. Details that the Bible is either obscure about, or which the things it says are really hard to systematize and figure out. And so some people do that better than others. Some people are studying it day and night, just like there's some professional physicists who are always studying and teaching physics. Some people are doing that with the Bible too. They're probably going to understand some things that the average Christian doesn't, but they're not all going to agree, just like, Newton's laws of, Newton and Galileo and others were discovering things about physics that not everyone agreed with. And there was controversy in their day. Eventually, of course, the truth won out in many of these cases, and probably in the area of theology that's true too. But there are seasons where people have certain prejudices. I'm told, I don't know if this is true, but I'm told that Galileo once was up on the Tower of Pisa, and he dropped two balls, one a heavy ball and one a lightweight ball, and they both hit the ground at the same time. Now, the orthodoxy of science at the time of physics was that heavy objects fall faster than light objects. But Galileo proved that that's not true. They fall at the same rate. However, even though he demonstrated that, lots of people in the scientific community still disputed it because it went against their orthodoxy. They had certain prejudices. Seeing is not always believing. Sometimes people have to be brought to a place where they're willing to let loose of a strong tradition in order to go with what they now have evidence to believe is the truth. That's true of physics. That's true of theology, too. A lot of times, the things, even some of the deeper things in theology, are not that hard to get at, except that we have traditions and prejudices that make it hard for us to accept them or see them. And if somebody else sees them before we do, instead of saying, wow, that's great, we see it as a threat to our tradition. And so that's why there's controversy and so forth. Now, there are some things that no matter how old you get, you probably won't have it all figured out, because there's deep things. Things that probably only God really fully understands. But I think it's like studying the physical world, studying the spiritual world. There's levels of depth, and you can go about as deep as you want to. But as you get further from the basic things, you're going to find things that are less obvious, clearly. I mean, they're less obvious. They're more obscure. There may be things that people interpret differently from each other because of the shortage of data on the specific point or something. And or simply that, you know, what is actually there to be found goes right against the prejudices that one has held. So there's a lot of things that make it hard to make advances, but it's worth the study, I think. Not everyone would find it so, but I do. I love to I've been studying the Bible for 50 years, and there's still some things I'm intrigued to learn. But not everyone would be as interested as everyone else. But you see, some things sound complex because, like on this show, people will call up sometimes to talk about things that are somewhat obscure things. And so I'll mention, well, there's this theory and there's this theory, and here's some thoughts, here's some verses that seem to go this way, here's some verses that seem to go the other way. That doesn't mean that the Bible is teaching two different things. It just means that what it is teaching isn't something you're going to get just from a light reading. You're going to have to really weigh evidences. You have to weigh arguments, weigh scriptures, and say, you know, it's going to take a little bit of commitment. But a person who doesn't want to commit to that kind of thing, they can learn the basics of what it means to be a Christian real quick. Listen, love God with all your heart, soul, mind. Love Jesus. Love your neighbors. You love yourself. Don't do any wrong to your neighbor. I'd say that you get along pretty good on just that. Some people are not satisfied to have only that. They'd like to have that and a deeper understanding of what God is like and so forth. And I think that's a worthwhile pursuit. But once you get past the really basic stuff, you better brace yourself to be hitting areas where there's different possibilities that people are going to see differently.
Well, that brings me to my second question. Not everyone believes in Christianity and Jesus. So when you start doing research and you start looking at why Jews don't believe in Jesus, how do we know that they're not right? I mean,
that's another way of saying how do we know that we are right?
Correct.
Right. If Jesus is who he said he is, then the Jewish religion, the Buddhist religion, the Hindu religion, and the Muslim religion are missing something. Namely, they're missing the truth about Jesus. Now, the question then is, do we have good reason to believe that Jesus is who he said he is? If we do, then we have good reason to believe we're right. And I think we have excellent reasons to believe he is who he said he is. We've got far better historical records, both from friendly and unfriendly sources, about Jesus' existence and what he stood for and what happened to him. We also have his own words recorded for us, not all of them, but a fair sampling. We also have eyewitness testimonies of things he did, including rising from the dead. We also have the ability to meet him even now, because he's the only founder of any religion who's alive today. You know, all the others are dead. He rose from the dead, and he can be known, and we relate with him. Those things being so, we certainly, potentially, could come to a very high degree of assurance that Jesus is who he said he is. I'm not saying that every Christian has the same experience or has done the same amount of research. I will say this, that the more research I do into world religions and into the evidences, the more I'm convinced there's really nowhere else to look for truth more than in Jesus himself. He is certainly who he claimed to be. That would be my experience and the result of my study. Each person has to reach that conclusion through their own search, of course. But the fact that Jesus rose from the dead, I think, goes a long way to putting him ahead of all the other religious founders.
Obviously, there are eyewitnesses, but many Jews don't believe in those eyewitnesses.
Yeah, why? That's to their detriment, yeah.
Why is that, though?
Because it goes against their religion. You see, people get very emotionally attached to their religion. And it's not just a personal thing. It's culture. It's family. It's history. It's ancestors. I mean, there's a sense in which, you know, if you're raised in India as a Hindu, or in Saudi Arabia as a Muslim, or in Tibet as a Buddhist, or in any country as a Jew, what you've got is a culture that permeates the society, the people you know, your friends, your family, your ancestors. They all held it this way. Now, if someone says, now, here's something else, here's something you're missing, and it'll actually lead you out of your own religious ideas into new ones. There are some people who are interested in the truth enough to say, well, I'll check it out because I want the truth. If my religion is wrong, then I'd rather have one that's more right. And they'll look into it, and usually when they do, they become Christians. But not everyone's eager to contemplate changing their religion. Changing their religion, first of all, they've got emotional attachment to it. Secondly, they have social attachment to it and cultural attachment to it. Many people will be, they'll have to say goodbye to their families and friends if they change their mind. Some people just aren't that interested in the truth. They'd rather live with a comfortable fantasy, if that's what their religion happens to be.
In doing research on Judaism, though, they say that Christians interpret the virgin birth incorrectly from Hebrew. Is that correct? Or
they do. They do say that, yeah.
And so what you're saying is that's not true?
Well, it depends. Is Jesus true or not? You see, my belief in Jesus does not depend on how one interprets Isaiah 7:14 and the virgin birth. I do believe in the virgin birth, and I do believe that Isaiah 7:14 is one of the passages that make reference to it. But even if it didn't, it wouldn't have any any impact on my belief in Jesus. My belief in Jesus isn't even tied inseparably to my understanding of the virgin birth. I do believe in the virgin birth, and I think it's important. But if someone would come along and say, well, there is no virgin birth and we can prove it, blah, 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 this way, I still have to evaluate Jesus on his own merits. He's a real person. He really lived, died, said things, rose again. And, you know, those are the things I have to deal with. Now, I believe the Jews are mistaken in saying that Christians misinterpret Isaiah 7:14. But that's a matter of interpretation. And again, it's a matter of interpretation based on biases. I am biased in favor of Jesus because of him. Therefore, I'm inclined to believe the Christian understanding of the verse. Jews are biased against Jesus because he threatens their religious system. Therefore, of course, they're going to interpret the verse their way. The way, you know, people don't usually interpret Scripture in a vacuum. They interpret it according to certain presuppositions and sometimes certain emotional commitments. And sure, the Jews say that Christians take all those prophecies about Jesus wrong, and they've got their own ways of interpreting them. But I mean, a person has to decide, are they going to follow Jesus? Is he worthwhile? See, I don't follow Jesus because of what the Old Testament says about him, although that's very significant. I follow Jesus because of what the New Testament says about him. And the Jews can't tell us that the New Testament is mistaken about him. It's written by the people who knew him.
How do we know? I mean, if you read some of these reasons behind why the Jews believe, and you start to think, well, maybe they have valid arguments. That's scary, because if you don't believe in Jesus, then you're not saved. So how does one come to a solid conclusion?
Well, again, it really comes down to one thing. It's quite simple. Did Jesus rise from the dead or didn't he? If he did, that's a pretty good proof that he's right and he's who he said he would. He said he was going to rise from the dead. If he pulled it off, that puts him ahead of everybody by a landslide. Now, the question of how Jews who don't believe in that he rose from the dead, don't believe in him, how they interpret certain texts that are capable of various interpretations, that to my mind is of secondary importance. If, you know, if Jesus rose from the dead, there's once in one sense, even if we never had the Old Testament, we'd still have reason to follow Jesus and believe in him. We do have the Old Testament, but of course, if we follow Jesus, we begin to see the Old Testament through his eyes, through his interpretation, not the interpretation of uninspired Jewish people. The Son of God would be much better authority on what the Old Testament means than any rabbi would be.
Did you ever wonder why Jesus didn't present himself, though, to the Jews, that he only presented himself to the disciples?
You mean after his resurrection?
Correct, correct.
I think it's because he had already told them, if you're not obeying the law and the prophets yet, you're not going to believe if someone rises from the dead. In the parable or the story of Lazarus and the rich man, Jesus seemed to be teaching that only those who are already obedient to God would be allowed to see him rise from the dead, that those who are ignoring the prior revelation of God, which most of Israel was, they wouldn't be convinced even if someone rose from the dead and appeared to them. So God didn't grant them that. I personally think that it's really strictly a historical question. You know, the question of interpretation of Old Testament texts is secondary, to my mind, to the question of whether Jesus is who he said he is. If he is, that colors the proper interpretation of the Old Testament in a big way. Listen, I'm almost out of time, and I've got other calls waiting.
Okay, thank you very much.
I appreciate your call, Jane. Thank you for
Bye-bye.
Calling. Bye now. Okay, we're going to talk next to Heather from Everett, Washington. Heather, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. I had a question regarding prophecy. My understanding of what's happened has changed because I used to only pretty much read the gospel and the book of Revelation, and I found that I didn't understand it until I went back and looked in the Old Testament to see where they were coming from.
Mm-hmm.
And it changed my whole perception of my whole belief system, really.
Yeah.
And I actually believe that all the prophecies have come true and that the kingdom is established right now.
Mm-hmm.
And am I wrong? And also, the prophecies that are still out there, do you have like a list of what you would say prophecies that have not yet been fulfilled?
Well, the prophecies that have not yet been fulfilled, I believe, are the ones that talk about the resurrection from the dead and the final judgment. And there are, you know, there's a variety of those. I don't have a list of them, but from time to time, you come across such a prophecy in the Bible. I agree with you that the kingdom of God has been established. I don't believe the kingdom of God has been consummated or has reached its full potential. Jesus said the kingdom of God was like a mustard seed, very small, that would grow into a great tree. Or Daniel said it was like a little stone that would grow to a great mountain to fill the earth. This growth is going on now. And so it started when Jesus was here as a very small enterprise. But it's become a huge worldwide thing now. And I believe that ultimately all people will acknowledge Jesus. So every knee will bow and every tongue will confess that Jesus is Lord. That hasn't happened yet. That is predicted. The universalization of the acknowledgement of Christ has not yet occurred. But the fact that he has established his kingdom and that it is a growing thing in the world and that you and I are in it, if we have followed Jesus Christ, we've been translated out of the power of darkness into the kingdom of his own dear Son. Those things are certainly affirmed in Scripture. So the kingdom has come. It has just not come to its full growth yet, to its full universal acknowledgement yet.
Yeah. the thing about the mustard seed and the faith growing, that one scares me because I actually think that your faith grows when you are struggling because you're forced to just allow God to take over. And I really think I agree with the caller prior, there will be a lot of suffering and struggling, but I do think that that's the fine-tuning of our faith growing, because we're going to have to rely on God more and more.
I think you're probably right. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. I really enjoy. One other question. My sister lives in Mississippi, and we both have a hard time over the Abraham story. She says, why would a loving God force Abraham to sacrifice his son?
He didn't. He forced him not to.
That's right. And he actually sacrificed his own son.
Right.
And I couldn't see that until I actually went back, and your tapes helped so much. But I referred her to your tapes. I told her, listen to that first, and then we'll talk again, because we just disagreed on the whole thing. But can she get your website in Mississippi?
You can get the website anywhere in the whole world.
Anywhere. Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right, great. Thank you so much.
Just give her thenarrowpath.com, and she can be anywhere on the planet. She can get that website.
Yes. Thank you.
Okay, Heather, I appreciate your call.
Bye.
God bless you. Bye now. Not much time left. Jim from Oregon, you're going to have the last word, but I'm afraid it won't be as long as I wish it could be. Go ahead.
Just short. I like doing Isaiah 53:4. When he bore our, I'm hearing, sorrows, sin. What is the correct word? Did he bore?
He bore our sorrows. It can be translated pains and sicknesses. The Hebrew word that it says, he bore our iniquities and carried our sins.
Okay.
Those words, iniquities and sins, can be translated as, or pains, I think it is, can be translated sicknesses and pains. And in other words, the verse, Isaiah 53:4, can be talking about Jesus bearing our moral burden for us.
Yeah.
Or it can be referring to him bearing a physical burden of sickness. And many people take it in the latter way in order to say that Jesus purchased our sickness when he died for us. However, even if it is referring to sickness, it is not saying necessarily that he purchased sickness, but that, as it says in, you'll see that verse is quoted over in Matthew 8:17 and interpreted for us.
Mm-hmm.
In Matthew 8:17, Jesus spent the whole night, into the night, he was healing all kinds of sick people in Capernaum. And yeah. Matthew says, so that it might be fulfilled, which was written. And then he quotes our verse that Jesus bore our sicknesses and our pain. So the fulfillment of that was not at the cross. The fulfillment of that was when Jesus was healing the sick people. And so Jesus did, in fact, heal many sick people. But some people want to take that verse to mean that he basically guaranteed the healing of all sickness through what he did at the cross. And that's not the way the New Testament uses that verse.
Number, you don't name it and claim it thing. But
right, that's right.
That's what I thought. I just wanted to hear you and get the correct Hebrew word for it.
All right, brother. I'm out of time, I'm afraid. I wish that wasn't
right.
So. God bless you, Jim.
God bless
Bye
you.
Now. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. This program is on Monday through Friday for an hour each afternoon. If you'd like to ever call in with a question, that's what we do it for. It's just so you can call in with whatever questions you have. Or you can listen in and hear what other questions people ask other people and what kinds of things might be said about them. We are a listener-supported ministry. We pay for the radio time, big bucks, actually, and we have no source of income here except for listeners like yourself. If you'd like to help us pay the radio bills, you can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Or you can just go to our website, thenarrowpath.com. A lot of free stuff there, but you can donate there too. thenarrowpath.com. Have a good day. Let's talk again tomorrow. God bless you.